Scientists are reporting that an enormous glacier-sized area of beef and pork product broke free of Iowa today and is expected to cause an alarming rise in global meat levels. Joe Hartwig of the Iowa Beef Center warns the drifting meat shelf could have devastating effects for the North American continent.
Neighboring states simply aren't equipped to handle that much meat.
Some scientists theorize the entire continent was once covered in a 40-foot layer of pork ribs, but was slowly barbecued out of existence by early man.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. Intro by The Onion, theonion.com. Thank you very much. Got to tell you guys something. Last episode, great response. You guys either talked about Greg Kane at Fine Lobster or Megan Fox. Nothing else. It further proves that I have a heavy male audience, and I do mean heavy. Allison and the team at Audit Media went all out with the promotion, too. They did Twitter, Facebook, of course, but they produced a press release, which was really well written, and created a podcast section on their site. Not only put the interview with Greg Kane on there, but they also added the entire episode to their site and included the official My Life as a Foodie logo on there with our Dia de los Muertos chef. Totally cool. And if you haven't already, visit finelobster.com. Take advantage of their free shipping offer on $100 or more that's still going. Live Maine lobsters. You're not going to taste anything like this. If if you're used to having lobster, you see lobster in those tanks. If they're not Maine lobster, not the same. Believe me, it does taste a lot different. We're going to talk about our trip to Sonoma in this episode, but I want to talk about magazines for a second. There was big news last week. Condé Nast, which publishes Details, Bon Appetit, Modern Bride, GQ, I think, and a host of others, made a decision to close down Gourmet magazine. Now, this decision literally caused a full-on street riot by foodies. Twitter was on fire. Blogs were on fire. Everybody was talking about this. The question was, why Gourmet? Why not Bon Appetit instead? And the answer from Condé Nast was that this was a matter of advertising. It's a matter of dollars. Which publication sold more advertising? And if you look really hard at both magazines, there's no question that Bon Appetit sells more ads. It made more money for the company at a time when print publications are having a hard time keeping the lights turned on. It simply makes more money for Condé Nast, and somebody had to go. And the reason it sells more ads is because it's a magazine geared toward middle-of-the-road foodies. I'm not knocking Bon Appetit, okay? Or the readers of Bon Appetit. Don't take that the wrong way. I subscribe to Bon Appetit, too, okay? I think it's a very good magazine. But when you compare it to Gourmet, it's a lot less sophisticated. And when it comes to numbers, more people watch Paula Deen than Gourmet's Diary of a Foodie. Now, does that make Paula Deen's show better? No. No, hell no. It's unwatchable to me. It's just a show that appeals to a wider audience, a less sophisticated audience, but that audience is more apt to buy Kraft salad dressing, whereas someone who reads Gourmet is going to make their own. I mean, hell, all you need to make salad dressing is vinegar, olive oil, seasonings, and herbs. But see, that's the difference. So if they can sell a full-page ad for Kraft dressing, they're going to sell that. And that's not going to run in Gourmet because people who read Gourmet aren't going to buy it. That's going to run in Bon Appetit. I'm going to read pieces of the official memo that the big cheeses over at Condé Nast sent to their employees last Monday in regards to Gourmet and closing it down. Now, they also killed some bridal magazines and another magazine called Cookie. I don't know what the hell that is, but there were other magazines that fell too. I'm going to just kind of just go through this, just the stuff that applies to Gourmet. We have now completed an extensive review of our business, an important undertaking given the dramatic changes in the U.S. economy. The review has led us to a number of decisions designed to navigate the company through the economic downturn and to position us to take advantage of coming opportunities. Condé Nast's success comes from the ability of our publications to attract readers with a wide range of interests, as well as advertisers who value them. But in this economic climate, it's important to narrow our focus to titles with the greatest prospects for long-term growth. As a result of our review, Gourmet Magazine will cease monthly publication, but we will remain committed to the brand, retaining Gourmet's book publishing and television programming, and gourmet recipes on Epicurious.com. We will concentrate our publishing activities in the Epicurean category on Bon Appetit. These changes, combined with cost and workforce reductions now underway throughout the company, will speed the recovery of our current business and enable us to pursue new ventures. In the coming weeks, we hope to announce initiatives to develop digital versions of our brands that will make use of new devices and distribution channels. Condé Nast is now in its 100th year of creating the most respected and iconic brands in the publishing world. These changes will ensure that our unique publishing company will continue in its preeminent position for many years to come. Now, I know this is a really hard pill to swallow, but print publishing is dying. The web is killing print. People get their news online, whether on their computer or on their phone, and they read more things online now than they do in magazines and newspapers. And even books are starting to die because of instruments like this Kindle from Amazon. I don't like that it's happening, but it is happening. Free stuff is killing everything, and it's seeping its way into everything else, including movies. Believe it or not, this Redbox, you heard about this? This big kiosk that you see in all these markets? They rent movies for a dollar. New releases, $1 a night. Some movie studios started preventing Redbox from renting their movies until they were on the market for over a month. They said, listen, you want to sell our product for $3 less than it's worth, we're going to make you pay for it. Now, this wasn't the studios being greedy. It's the studio saying, listen, you're going to kill our industry by selling us for less than we're worth. You're undervaluing our product. And we spend a shitload of money to create these movies. Everybody knows that. Now, it's debatable how valuable some of the movies are because, in general, people complain that the quality of films now are, you know, not as good as they have been in, you know, years or decades past. But the reason I bring movies into this is very simple. Look at what makes money. Kid movies, silly movies, big noisy blockbusters. That, when you watch on a smaller screen at home or on your iPod, not nearly as exciting or entertaining, but they make a ton of money. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Horrible, but it made an ass load of cash. But when you have movies that I think are near masterpieces that hardly make any money at all, you know, that's sad. But that's Gourmet Magazine now, isn't it? I like Oscar-caliber films, and I like Gourmet's Diary of a Foodie. But Transformers 2 and Semi-Homemade put more asses in the seats. They make more money for their investors because they sell more. It sucks, but it's true. And listen, there's still Savoir, there's still Food and Wine, and I hate to say it, but Esquire and GQ doing a pretty damn good job right now covering food. They really are. Food is hip right now, and it's just getting hipper. Now, I think it's a bad idea to kill Gourmet when you could have killed Details. You could have killed, you know, if you got a magazine called Cookies, what the hell? What else do you have that you might be able to scrap? But if it's not selling, it's not selling. There are resources for foodies out there. And according to Condé Nast, Gourmet.com and this Diary of a Foodie show on PBS will continue. I just think they need to sell more advertising and get more money behind it. So listen, if it's not in your area, you know, encourage your local PBS station to pick it up, you know, make some noise and see if you can get it shown there, and maybe they can get more money behind the show. Okay, so it seems that always in the fall, Katrina and I end up taking our vacation. I don't know why it is. Summer's always too busy. And, you know, it's when everyone else is taking vacation. You just don't want to be around everyone else and their kids. And our trip always revolves either around art events or something else or some other event. But it's always around something. It's either the Great American Beer Festival, which I go to with friends because I don't think she'd be that into it. Maybe for an hour and then she'd get tired. Besides, you know, GABF, kind of a big sausage party. And I don't think that she'd want to hang out there. But one of the things we do, and we do a lot of, is we visit Sonoma and Napa, which is, you know, north of where we live, in wine country. We have a relaxing week. We wine taste, visit some breweries, eat at some nice restaurants. Thomas Keller's Ad Hoc is up in Napa. We cap it off with this art show on the weekend that they have every year. We collect some art from there. And the one year we did Hawaii, and then we did Napa, Sonoma, GABF, and we kind of, you know, fluctuate. This year it was Sonoma again. And next year I'm definitely going to GABF, so any of you who are thinking of going, it'd be great to see you up there. I'm not going to do anything but just party and drink. I'm not videotaping. I'm not blogging. I'm not going to podcast. I'm just shoot some pictures and drink beer. So, and that's next year. So this year, we started preparing for this trip a while back, and we had a few goals in mind. This time, we wanted to drink wine at some wineries that are out of the way, that we never heard of, and we wanted to eat at restaurants that cook like ad hoc cooks, sourced locally, cooked simply, done really well. And of course, visit ad hoc, as we do every time, the Bouchon Bakery, which is, you know, right down the street. We do that every time too. Leading up to this, Charles at 100 miles. That's the number one, 100miles.blogspot.com. If you haven't visited yet, I urge you to do it now. Stop this podcast, go to this website, bookmark it, and then come back. All right. This man thinks like we think. He's got the passion for locally sourced food prepared in a classic French tradition, and there's absolutely no BS on his blog. He does not screw around. It's just about food. So anyway, he and his partner, Robert, they go to Sonoma, they spend the week, and Charles, as he describes in his post about his trip to Sonoma, really starts to realize, and he realized it long ago, but this, it really sunk into him this time, that the area that surrounds Sonoma, Napa, kind of reminds him a lot of France. And he should know, because he was just there months before. So I thought it was cool to read that, because I love when people reaffirm this. Sonoma is like the French countryside. Sonoma, Napa, a lot like France, with more traffic probably. You know, it's a lot of cars. Anyway, so he discovers this breakfast and lunch place. It's tucked away in the back of a bookstore in downtown Hillsburg. It's called Bavolo. And the logo for this place is nothing more than American typewriter font and this line drawing from the 1940s of a snail. The idea is slow food fast. You know, slow food, that's what we like, cooked quickly. So you can get in and out, you can eat, but you're eating good stuff. And once you grasp that idea, it all starts to make sense. This place is really unassuming. It's in the back of a bookstore, for Christ's sake. You have to like this, because when you see the menu, you don't see a lot of items on it, because they'll only serve you what they can source locally and, you know, what's in season. So it's going to change often. So, and you're always going to have a lot of options. You know, go to McDonald's, there's 500 options because, you know, they freeze everything and everything's processed. Not a problem. Bavolo is run by chefs Dusky Estes and John Stewart, who also own and run Zazu Restaurant and Farm, which Charles later talks about in his blog, as well as the Black Pig Meat Company, where John makes his own bacon, which he serves at his restaurants. This, my friends, is a lot to process, because based on Charles' recommendations, we had made reservations for Zazu for dinner later that night and planned our day kind of like, we're going to eat breakfast here, we're going to do some wine tasting, get something in our bellies, go do wine tasting, and then go to Zazu for dinner. When I found out that John made his own bacon, and it's from free-range pigs, farm-raised, well-treated, with respect type of pigs, you know, I just had to have some of that. So we ordered the Black Pig bacon, egg, and bellwether cheese sandwiches. They're little breakfast sandwiches. Came on these really fresh rolls with pickled grapes on the side. Now, what are pickled grapes? These are grapes that have been quick pickled in vinegar, brown sugar, and spices like cinnamon sticks, star anise, ginger, bay leaves. Holy shit. It's like little balls of Christmas are bursting in your mouth. It literally tastes like the holidays. I have the recipe for those, too. I'm including a link on the website to a salumi and antipasti menu that chefs Dusky and John shared on the web. I'll go over the recipe for pickled grapes at the end of the show. They're really easy to make. You just have to make these. And make them with really fresh grapes, too. They're just absolutely perfect. The Italian table features lots of things, but among my favorites are antipasti, pickles, cheeses, salami, lots of pork. Dusky and John pretty much live and die by these principles, it seems to me anyway. The bacon was incredible. It was like ham. The sandwich was a perfect breakfast. The grapes blew me away. The atmosphere of this place is just so what I needed on my first morning in Sonoma. I just was, you know, I'm a foodie, man. I think about this stuff all the time. I wake up thinking about it. To have breakfast like this, in a place like this, with this kind of an experience, it was everything I wanted. Right? At that point, everything I wanted. We sat alone in this little dining area, this huge painting of a pig on the wall. I'm including photos on the website, too. I might do a slideshow or something. I haven't decided. I took a lot of pictures, so I probably should do some kind of a slideshow to get them all in. There was an outside eating area. They were growing tomatoes out there. They had a grill out back where I figured they probably did some kind of a live grilling party at some point. I really didn't want to leave, but I knew I had to. I just felt like I was visiting someone's house. We had to, you know, we had wine to drink, we had things to do, and I had a really good base in my stomach that I knew would last me, you know, for most of the day. This bacon is not what you come to expect bacon to be. You know, it's like I said, it's like ham. They get their pork from Pure Country Pork in the Pacific Northwest. It was the first sustainable hog operation in the United States to earn a Food Alliance certification. That's a big deal. They're heritage breed pigs. They have no antibiotics, no hormones, no performance-enhancing drugs. They're not doing the clear. You know, they're not taking steroids. They roam. They eat what they want, when they want. They're free-range piggies. All right? That's where the flavor's coming from. And most of the bacon that you eat from the grocery store is wet-cured belly from factory pigs. That's why it's so small and thin. You see this stuff? This anemic-looking bacon? Wait till you get a load of this. It's fat. I mean, this is a big freaking pig. This thing has grown on its own, eating whatever the hell it wants. It's in, the stuff that you get in the store is injected with liquid smoke. Takes maybe 24 hours to cure. Nah, man, that's not how you cure bacon. Bacon takes, you know, 2 weeks to 3 weeks to cure. Black Pig Meat Company dry cures their bacon with brown sugar. Takes about 21 days to finish it, about 3 weeks. Then they smoke it over real applewood. No, you know, liquid smoke. Smoke it over applewood. Takes about half a day to do that. And, you know, they say they don't do a lot, but they do it really well. Quality over quantity. That's the deal, man. So we bought some of John's bacon. We put it in our ice chest. We went wine tasting. Of the wineries that we visited, Pedroncelli, the very first one, was one that not only had I not heard of it before, but it was really unassuming. It had been around for a long time, but it was really unassuming. Wine tasting, it's very subjective. You have to be in the mood for wine tasting, and the wine kind of has to be in the mood for you. You know, you have to know where to go. You don't go to the most popular places unless you're prepared for crowds, parties, you know, a bunch of drunk people, expensive tasting fees, general snootiness from the staff, an overall bad experience. Believe me, these big wineries, stay the hell away from them. Go to wineries that you've never heard of, those that are off the beaten path, hard to find, tucked away. Basically, those that either don't want to charge you for tastings or charge a small fee like $5, which usually ends up getting refunded to you if you buy a bottle of wine, which you will probably do anyway because you're going to find something that you like. Pedroncelli was this kind of place. The guy running the tasting room, his name was John, and he was so gracious and so friendly and so informative. He's sitting there drinking his coffee, kept pouring wine, and I'm like, you got to take it easy here, you know? Seriously, I could have kicked it there all day and just talked wine with this dude because that's the kind of guy he was. Now, I'm a beer guy, right? I like wine, but I'm really a beer guy. I like champagne more than I like wine. But we tasted grapes fresh off the vine. We tasted about 8 of their wines, purchased quite a few bottles that I know are going to kick serious ass when we serve them at a future dinner party. We visited quite a few lesser-known wineries that day. We had a good time. I mean, it was a really good day, but my mind was on Zazu. My mind was on Black Pig Meat Company. My head was thinking about making bacon. It was really kind of strange how everything fell in place because it just so happens I purchased Michael Ruhlman's book, Charcuterie, and I brought it with us. It was something I'd been meaning to dig into for a long time, and for some reason, this kind of happened to fall into place. When I got home, I was going to start this thing. I was going to cure and smoke my own pork belly. I was going to start making bacon. I was going to start making plans to dry cure salami, pepperoni, hot copa, because if I didn't jump in now, when was I going to do it? You know, I have the show, I have my blog, I have a voice. You guys are all into this stuff with me. You know, we can bounce ideas off of each other. I feed off of your input, I really do. So I figure, you know, while I have you, while I have your attention, before I get boring, I should share this stuff with you. And that, you know, we can talk about it. And maybe you'll get into it. I mean, that's always my hope. Then I would, you know, kind of encourage you to do it too, because then I'll have company. But, you know, we did sausage party on here. We did the Italian sausage thing, and I got into that, but then I stopped. I mean, I still make sausage, but I didn't get past that, so now I need to, and this is the way I was going to do it. Anyway, dinner time rolls around, and we drive to Zazu, which is located in Santa Rosa. It's the same town where we were staying, and this is how it is. If you go to their website, ZazuRestaurant.com. There's the plug, by the way. ZazuRestaurant.com. Z-A-Z-U. Okay? If you go there and you check the menus, it looks like this. Autumn, winter, spring, summer. That should be your first clue. Why do they break it down by season? Because they only serve things that are in season. And you can pretty much guess that if they're taking the care to do that, they're getting it fairly locally. But let me tell you something. You don't even know how locally they're getting some of it. Try the back of the restaurant. Remember earlier I said Zazu Restaurant and Farm? Yeah, that's where the farm part comes in. You park in it. I parked my car right in front of a huge plot of Swiss chard, lettuce, and other leafy greens. And these people don't screw around. You want to stand behind their dishes, you got to know where the ingredients are coming from. I mean, you know, people come up, you mean to tell me you care so much about the quality that you grow the stuff yourself? Well, here's my checkbook. I love this. This is how everybody should be cooking anyway. This is how everyone should be cooking all the time. Every restaurant should be doing this. Walk in, the first thing you see on this door is the Zagat sticker. This place, it looks like a big barn, like a giant cafe that was made out of barn wood. On the side of a highway, cars whizzing by. This is Zagat rated. You know a good chef cooks here. And let me get off track here for 1 second, okay? I want to say something here. I'm going to be quite frank, and I'm sorry. When it comes to choosing restaurants to eat at, I either go by word of mouth, I go by blogs that I trust like 100 Miles or Joe's My Last Bite or Gastronomy Blog, Catherine Wren's Gastronomy Blog. The reason I go to these sites is because when they put a stamp of approval on new restaurants, Joe eats out quite a bit, all right? So if it's decent, it's going to be on her blog. Or I'll visit Zagat.com because I trust Zagat. But the reason I go to these other blogs is because they don't crap on stuff. If it's not there, it's not good. And listen, Joe eats out a lot. She goes to restaurants all the time. That's her hobby. That's what she does. She visits restaurants. And if they suck, they don't make it. And if they don't make it, I'm not going. But, you know, I trust Zagat, but Yelp and these food bloggers who criticize restaurants, who actually think they're real food critics. Listen, dude, I read some of your blogs, and seriously, some of you really suck at writing, which is the first thing you should be actually good at before you start your career, if you want to call it that, as an unemployed food critic. There are lots of blogs that I love to read for reviews. Joe at My Last Bite, Charles when he actually reviews stuff. Usually he writes about food like, you know, I talk about food. Catherine at Gastronomy Blog. They write about when they have positive experiences at them. And they encourage me to try these places. And it's always food that I like to eat anyway. The worst thing that I see are anonymous bloggers, we go by anonymous names, who rip the shit out of restaurants and hurt business at a time when they can ill afford to lose business. And you know what? To go anonymous, that's chicken shit. Seriously, dude, that is chicken shit. At least have the balls to show your face. Put your name out there. These chefs aren't faceless, and they've got the balls to try some of the dishes that they do. And they put it on the table. I mean, that takes more of a man than you, my friend. You're just another Yelp critic with a larger voice because you have a blog and a seemingly bottomless pockets, apparently. If I want to know how good a restaurant is, and a blogger like Joe hasn't already been there to give me a recommendation, I'll go to Zagat.com or the Zagat Guide, not Yelp, and certainly not some wannabe food critic's blog. There's a reason Zagat exists, because it has teeth. You don't, so shut the fuck up. Okay, so back to dinner. Man, this place was cozy, nice and peaceful. The menu features things that we saw on their site, you know, because they kind of give you a general idea, but it's always based on what they can get. And some things that obviously they were able to source locally, you know, maybe more recent than they were able to update their site and kind of provide to us. The first thing that we ordered, which we had to try, was a salumi platter. We had to try John's Salumi. The waitress told us that this guy is so into pork and preparing it that he goes on several trips to Italy to learn how to properly dry cure salami like they do in Italy. Very authentic. The guy really likes to dry cure pork. He's really into it. So we ordered two different varieties of his salami, so oregano and thyme, and some of his dry hot copa. I'm an absolute sucker for hot copa, the dry stuff. It's salty, porky, spicy as hell. It's everything that I expect from any Italian deli meat. John's was superb. It tasted Italian. It was nice and briny. It wasn't too spicy. Perfectly cured. Nice and just perfect, man. Just exactly what I wanted to have. But for as much as I love that, his salami was the freaking bomb. It was dense. It was dry. It was not, you know, the soft, weak shit you get in the grocery store now in the Italian deli section. Gallo, please, don't even call that salami. After having this, this is salami. I like hard salami. Salami that has been dried the hell out. The oregano salami tasted rich with fragrant oregano. Same with the thyme variety. There was this down-to-earth pepperiness that makes this salami better than anything I tasted previously. And to be honest, I've got my doubts as to whether or not I can ever come close to making salami really that good. I don't like mushy salami, and I'm afraid that's what I'm going to end up making, and I'll figure it out. I like it rigid. I really do. I like it hard and dry, just tough. That's what this was. It was the real deal. Kind of like cowboy jerky. You know, people make jerky all the time, and they end up making jerky that's kind of mushy. You want it dry. You want it, you know, really hard to bite off. That's what this stuff was. Dry cured, man. It should be dry. It should be no moisture in it. There was an assortment of olives on the plate. It was just heaven, man. I just love eating like this. Pickles and pork. So for dinner, I ordered a pork chop that resembled kind of a porterhouse steak. It had a bone in it, kind of like a T-bone almost. Really thick, had this nice T-bone at the top. It was from a Duroc pig that was grown locally from a farmer in Hillsburg. That came with grilled peaches and quinoa with walnuts. It's kind of like rice almost. This pork chop had been brined before it was grilled. So the flavor in this thing was just all pork, really concentrated, nothing else. So incredibly flavorful and tender too. In fact, as I got closer to the bone, the meat started to pull away from the bone so easily that I didn't need my knife. I was literally pulling the meat off the bone with my fork. You taste this, then you taste any other pork. Immediately, you begin to see the difference between free-range and factory-raised. There is a really big difference, and you're kind of cheating yourself if you don't try it. Maybe it's an additional $2 a pound, but it's worth it. It really is. Katrina had a flat-iron steak that was cooked almost black on the outside, totally medium-rare on the inside, perfectly done. Again, locally sourced beef, not a factory cow. Point Reyes blue cheese ravioli. Point Reyes blue cheese is a blue cheese that was wild and nutty. It was so great. We went to a local grocery store the next day, found two wedges of it, brought it home with us. If you like blue cheese, it's not over the top spicy, but with really good earthiness to it, Point Reyes or anything like Point Reyes is perfect. Again, you know, this is stuff you can only get out there. I mean, even down here, I can't find it. I'd have to like really look hard for it. It's tough. Oh, and some of the Swiss chard that I had parked my car in front of, yeah, it was on Katrina's plate. She had some sautéed Swiss chard on her plate. It was phenomenal. You know, they just picked it earlier that day and cooked it. You know, though, as content and happy as I was, as dinner wound down and we started to share dessert, I started to realize something, and I talked to Katrina about this. I think I live in the wrong place to be doing a show like this. If I lived in Sonoma, you know, my life as a foodie would be 10 times more informational. I'd be able to provide tons more information because I'd be surrounded by artisanal cheesemakers, local growers, chefs like this, people who make salumi. I'd learn more. As it is, I don't get firsthand experience with this stuff without going through a lot of work to get it. I meet a lot of people. I meet lots of growers and farmers here, but I have to work really hard to get to it because many of the people I talk to aren't even near me. I mean, there, it's all around you. You're surrounded by it. You don't have to work hard to find it there. The problem is, I love where I am. I love my house. I love my job. I love my friends. I'm not moving away. I've got a really nice job. Katrina's got a career. So living there is a fantasy. I think it's a fantasy for a lot of people. But I can say with certainty that anybody who lives up there, Sean Paxton, Rick Sellers, Peter Huey, Sean O'Sullivan at 21st Amendment Brewing, my new friend Jesse over at beerandnosh.com, you guys are surrounded with the best food, the best beer, which some of you are responsible for in part because you guys brew some of the best beer in California anyway. You have the best growers, the best farmers. You have the best of everything when it comes to food. I envy that because it's hard here, man. I got to work hard to get this stuff. I've got to go there to find it, and then I've got to go here to locate it. So anyway, the last thing I want to mention about this, because it was pretty cool what happened about 3 minutes before we left. I pay the check. I'm finishing my coffee. I decide I'm going to visit the men's room before we take off. This place is kind of semi-rustic, okay? Like I said, it's like an old roadside cafe. It's made from, you know, just, you know, old wood. I go into the restroom, and right there on the wall, right in the bathroom, is a framed certificate from the James Beard Foundation thanking Chef Dusky for her years of participation in the foundation, recognizing her efforts in the bathroom. Where else do you go where one of these certificates even appear in the restaurant? This one's hanging up in the bathroom like it's no big deal. Like we needed someone to put it somewhere. I don't know. We'll hang it in the bathroom. I love that, man. That's just very unpretentious. It just tops the cake. It's the icing on the cake. Of course, you know, I pulled my phone out. I'm in the bathroom. No one can see me. I pull out my phone. I snap a picture of it. Lighting was horrible. It was all green, so I made the photo black and white. But I had to snap a picture, so I'll put that also in the slideshow. But the funniest part about this was that the next night, you know, we had reservations at Ad Hoc in Yountville. You know, we normally get a really great meal there, one that's so good. It's just like this, one that we rave about for a week afterward, locally sourced and stuff. We were saying at dinner, Ad Hoc's on the clock. Well, they could very well disappoint us now. Could they come away and make a meal that compared to this? I had my doubts, but Ad Hoc has never disappointed me in the past. As it turns out, it was perfect too. And to be honest, I'm glad because I love Ad Hoc. At Ad Hoc, and I know I've talked about them before, I did a whole show on it, you don't pick your meal there. It's a fixed menu. They know what they're going to get that morning. They make the menu based on what they have. The minute they know what they have on hand, they can build a menu. They publish the menu, and that's what they're going to serve that night for dinner. And it's price fixed. It's never more, never less than it always is, $49. So for dinner, here's what we had. Dungeness crab salad, marinated Korean melon, Lola Rosa, Belgian endive, Romano beans, fried garden grape tomatoes, which were great, and opal basil. A roasted Colorado lamb sirloin came next with grilled padrones. Those are the padrone peppers from Spain, the Russian roulette peppers. They look like, I don't know, like a short, squatty Anaheim type of chili, right? Except that you'll get like 9 or 10 mild ones, and the 11th one will kick you in the balls. I mean, seriously, nasty. Unfortunately, I didn't get any hot ones. Wanted to, but didn't. That also had a Swiss chard and fennel ragu with banana fingerling potatoes that were seared and sautéed in olive oil, and a piquillo gremolata. Very nice. I mean, well constructed, and the lamb, of course, was superb. Colorado lamb. American lamb differs from New Zealand lamb or Australian lamb. That stuff's a bit gamey. So people who don't like lamb because it tastes kind of funny, that's why. Colorado lamb is kind of like pork and beef mixed together. It's kind of a cross between pork and beef. It's kind of hard to describe, but it's more, I don't even know how to describe that, but it's good. It doesn't have the gaminess to it. Then we had a cheese plate, which were Plogate Creamery's Hartwell, Sultana raisins with toasted sunflower seeds, and Marshall's Farm wildflower honey. They actually, you take the honey out. It's almost like jam. You take the honey out and you pour it over the cheese, and then you have some sunflower seeds on it, and you taste it. It's nuttiness that's like nuttiness on top of nuttiness with the sweetness of the honey. Really good way to have cheese. I mean, I always have cheese plate there, and they'll usually serve it with jam or honey, and it's pretty impressive. Then we had a raspberry cupcake for dessert with lemon curd and meringue frosting. Really good meal, well done, and as I said, if I had just had that, I'd have been happy. But I'd had the Zazu meal before, so it put pressure on that meal. And it was like, we scored 3 runs in the top of the 9th, what are you going to do in the bottom of the 9th? Well, they scored 3 runs too. I would certainly call it a tie. And that's saying something for Zazu, because we're talking about Thomas Keller's Ad Hoc, okay? I just can't say enough good things about this. It was such an impressive trip for both of us. But you know, I'm jumping the gun a little because before the meal, the coolest thing happened. When we visit Ad Hoc, it's in Yountville, okay? Yountville's in Napa. And Napa is on the other side of Sonoma. So we do wine tasting in the afternoon. We have a quiet picnic lunch, local salami that we purchased, a loaf of fresh bread, and some of that Point Reyes blue cheese that we purchased, and some bottled water. A good lunch, a light lunch, didn't want to eat too much. We were at Bartholomew Winery, which is in the town of Sonoma. Has this really great big picnic area for you to sit, have a quiet lunch. You're surrounded by the vineyards. You're in a little shade. It's very quiet. You can hear the wind blowing through the valley. It's very nice. Good way to have lunch. And we, of course, like I said, you know, you're out there. You're away from your hotel room. You're driving around. And, you know, you're kind of on your own. And it's kind of fun. So as we get within a couple of hours of our dinner reservation at Ad Hoc, we make our way to Yountville. We walk around till our reservation time. We try to kill some time. One of the places that we almost visit is Bouchon Bakery. The bakery is located right next to Bouchon Restaurant, which is the restaurant Thomas Keller opened with his brother in 1998, which was only 4 years after he opened the French Laundry, which is also, you know, in that area. Bouchon is more of a French bistro restaurant. You know about the French Laundry, right? It's this really fancy place. He does really fancy things with food. Multiple courses. It's very expensive, hard to get a reservation, and it's, you know, it's one of the highest rated restaurants every year in the United States. Bouchon is a French bistro, like Léal, where Bourdain worked. Not overly priced, actually quite affordable. If you look at the menu and look at the prices, very affordable. Considering the quality of the food that you're getting, it's, you know, Bouchon's not a bad place to pick if you're going to eat in that area. In fact, it was just before leaving on this trip that I decided to really start looking at the recipes in the Bouchon cookbook and try to stick to that style of cuisine for a while, because that really is how I like to cook. And I was talking to Jason, a friend of mine, listens to the show as well, and he said he had made the fried chicken recipe from the Bouchon cookbook and with the brine. And so I started to experiment with that brine, and it is fact is maybe one of the best brines for everything, including, you know, pork and chicken that I've ever tried. So that's kind of become a staple now for me. I think I've done it like, you know, 5 times now since I've been back. It's crazy. So the bakery, which is right next door, is really small. And I mean tiny. All right. It's a really small place. It has a small storefront. It's a case full of pastries, some bread along the back, and glass doors that open to the back of the house where all the bread and the pastries are made. There's this big oven. Now, I love this part because I love watching chefs work, and I love watching master bakers work. So the master baker happens to be there. He's preparing these rolls for the oven, and has started to snap pictures through the glass. Now, he notices me shooting pictures of him, and he just kind of smiles at me. He keeps doing his thing. So, and I don't know why, I decided that all of a sudden, it's okay for me to shoot pictures. So I start shooting pictures of everything. I'm shooting pictures of inside the stinky place. You know, thank God I've got a 24mm lens on this camera, because it's almost like a fisheye lens situation anyway. You're backed against the wall. We go outside. Katrina decides, you know, maybe she's thinking about bringing something back for the girls at the office, something that it'll keep for a couple of days before we get back to work. So we go back inside, and she starts talking to the girl behind the counter, you know, what'll last, what can I take with me? Immediately, I leave that conversation, go back to the glass, start shooting pictures of the master baker again. Now, this guy's now, he's buttering the rolls. Now he's looking at me with this kind of look on his face like, oh no. He's got this look of intent, right? And I'm thinking, oh crap, I may have, like, maybe I took too much pictures. Maybe I crossed the line a little bit. So he calls one of the girls from the front over to him and starts talking to her. And he looks at me, and then she looks at me, and I'm like, oh shit. You know, I crossed the line, so I put my camera back, and, you know, I kind of acted like nothing was happening. She comes out, and she says to me, the master chef would like to know if you would like to come back and have a tour of the back of the house. I didn't even hesitate. I went, yeah, we would. Absolutely. I look at Katrina, and she's like, yeah, of course, yeah, yeah. So they whisked us back in the back. Chef Matt McDonald starts to tell us what he's doing. He's actually preparing these rolls, these special rolls, for dinner at the French Laundry. It turns out that Matt is the big cheese. Chef Matt is the big cheese back there. He came to the Bouchon Bakery. He was part of the Bread Bakers Guild of America's Baking Team USA. They placed in the finals in 1999, 2002. He's been close to 20 years. He's been a professional baker. Pretty young guy, too. He puts this rare Greek salt on top of these rolls that he says accents the roll and offers some of the salt to us. Now, salt is not just salt. I mean, it's salt. But this stuff's really briny. It's bright salt. Like when you taste it, it's got a brininess to it that's kind of bright. You can tell well, salt is really super pure. The process that they use to make salt like this is as pure as it gets. Seriously, it's like tasting the sea, but it's like tasting the Mediterranean Sea. Really. It's different. So I asked him, is this where all the bread and pastries for the French Laundry are made? And he says, no way. You know, they've got an entire bakery for the French Laundry. They've got like five or six people work back there, and they make their own bread there. But these were special. They wanted him to make them. But they produce, in this little bakery, they produce all the pastries for the bakery, for the Bouchon Bakery, and for the restaurant next door, for Bouchon. So he calls Sharon, who's second in command there, and she brings us to the back. She is the one that heads up the back of the shop. She's second in command. When he's not there, she's in charge. You would not believe how small it is in the back of this place. Every square inch of this place is used. There's flour everywhere. The place smells like bread, like sugar. Like it smells like a professional bakery. It's got this scent, this raw scent of yeast and water. If you're a brewer or you know, if you've made bread before, you know that smell? Of yeast and water, that kind of meaty smell, that's what it smelled like. It's an unusual sweet smell of materials that really aren't ready yet, but kind of getting ready. It smelled great. I mean, it smells like art. Really, it's the best way I can describe it. It smells like art. This place was a mess. It was an organized mess, but it was messy because everyone's working. Everything had its place because it has to. And people were working like crazy. And, you know, what was impressive was, as crazy as it was for them, as much as they were working, everybody managed to smile at us and say hello. And they have an oven back there where all the pastries are baked, and it is maybe 7 feet tall and 4 feet wide and 4 feet deep. That's it. That's where everything, all the pastries are baked. She pulls these little Bouchon chocolate cakes out of the oven, the little tiny ones, and they're silicone racks to put on the cooling racks. And she looks at me and she says, 24/7 never stops. And I said, Sharon, wait, what? Like, what does that mean? She goes, it never closes here. This place is 24/7. We work around the clock. They don't close it. In order to keep up, they have to keep working. The demand is pretty high. I mean, go hang out there for an hour and you'll see 40 to 60 people walking through buying stuff. That's in the middle of the day on a Saturday. Imagine what that's like every day. I mean, people are in that town. They buy stuff. They go in the morning. I'm sure it's like France. They're there attacking that place for the fresh baguettes. In order to keep up, they've got to keep working. So they have shifts of pastry chefs coming through there, maybe three or four thick. I looked around. I didn't see any real area where they could physically let dough sit to rise. I bake bread, okay? That's pretty much the only thing I bake. I bake bread, I do pasta, and I'll do pizza dough. But I know how much room one loaf of bread needs to rise in my kitchen. Now, I imagine 500 loaves of that. I asked her, I said, where do you rise the dough? Where does the dough have room to rise? She points to the back wall. She goes, oh, right over there. I said, right over where? There's no room over there. She goes, everything has to stack on top of each other. Optimize space. We manage. That's what she said. We manage. I said, you don't manage. You do more than that. What you do here is magical. And I thought about this. In France, they don't have huge bakeries. They're small. Paris? Think about it. The size of that town, the number of buildings in it, and little bakeries, that's small too. You consider that. They don't have huge bakeries, and they manage, and they invented this stuff. Bouchon Bakery is like a slice of France, just as Bouchon is a slice of France, and for that matter, indicative of the entire area. They've taken what the French have done, their techniques, their lifestyle, their wine, their way of life, and carved their valley into their interpretation of France. And while I know there's only one Paris, if I ever want to get the feeling like I'm in our own little slice of what French living is, all I have to do is get into a car or plane, travel north about 400 miles, and I can experience things that I never can or could anywhere else but France.
Michael Taylor is a Washington insider with experience at the Food and Drug Administration going all the way back to 1976 when he started as a lawyer there. He's back and drawing some flack in his new capacity as Senior Food Safety Advisor to FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg.
We have real serious food safety issues that, you know, Mike Taylor is qualified to deal with, but there are other people that don't carry the baggage that he does.
In the early 90s, Taylor was on duty at the FDA as Deputy Commissioner for Policy when the Monsanto Company secured approval for a genetically modified growth hormone for cows. Critics charged it made milk dangerous. The FDA argued that could not be proven, and eventually Taylor moved out of government into Monsanto, where he became Vice President of Public Policy. Now that Taylor's back at the FDA, critics question whether it's appropriate for him to be in a position where he might be called upon to evaluate the impact of bovine growth hormones.
There's a growing body of research showing that when you fool around with hormones, it can cause various cancers, not all cancers, but some cancers. And it can have other kinds of detrimental effects on human health.
The FDA says the commissioner has full faith and trust in Michael Taylor, a one-time food safety official at the Agriculture Department, who before this appointment was a university research professor. Supporters say he's carried the flag for food safety.
We've never actually seen any evidence that Mr. Taylor's time with the industry, a brief period, has had an effect on his ability to think critically about the issues that affect consumers or his ability to act decisively to protect the public health.
Food Safety Group insiders say this appointment recognizes his political support and service on food policy issues during the Obama campaign and transition.
So you know Scripps, who started Food Network, is turning Fine Living, which has already kind of been a dumping ground for old Food Network shows, into a new channel called The Cooking Channel. Now, this goes back to what I've been saying for a long time. Food Network is like MTV. They started by showing instructional cooking shows that people liked. MTV showed videos 24/7. Remember in the early 80s, that's all they did. But then they started reality shows and talk shows and other crap. And before you knew it, they weren't even showing videos that much. So they started MTV2, which now only shows videos. And I don't even know. I don't even watch MTV anymore, so maybe they don't even do that anymore. But Food Network should be doing this. They should, you know, because they had a really good thing going and pissed a lot of people off when they started making this other crap. So now it looks like Fine Living might be coming just that. Again, if you don't think food and cooking is hot right now, look around you. Men's magazines that I read 5 years ago, these magazines were maybe including a recipe or two for bachelors 3 times a year tops. Now, almost every issue has something. And they've got annual food issues, too. The new Esquire has this annual food issue. You can't miss it. It has a half-naked Kate Beckinsale on the cover. It's fantastic. It was a food is hot. I think this cooking channel might be a big deal. I know a lot of people have their doubts about it, but it could be kind of promising. So we'll keep our eyes peeled for that. FLN, Fine Living Network, will be coming the cooking channel maybe in 2010. And listen, I want to thank listeners Samuel and Rich. I want to call them out for their really nice emails. I got emails from these guys within the last month. I love to get emails from people who listen to the show. But these emails that I get are very, very special. They tell me that, you know, they've been listening for a while and that my show has helped them change the way they see food. They slowed down a little bit. They started trying new things. Or maybe generally they were foodies already. And, you know, that just kind of helped them realize that they were like me. Because, you know, guys, it sounds like you guys were already there. You know, maybe our show just helped you realize that you liked it as much as I do. Because that's how I feel. But when a complete stranger sends you an email and says, hey, you know, my wife and I love your show. Thanks for doing it. And Samuel said, you know, he and his wife, they have to fight over the computer. Who's going to listen first? I'm going to tell you something. And in case, you know, anybody out there thinks that I don't appreciate it, I really, really do. I mean, I do. Thanks again for taking time out of your day to email me that stuff. It means everything to me. It really does. to know that people are listening. I know some people don't like to comment on the board, on the blog. That's all right. You don't have to comment. I've got a lot of people who comment all the time, and that's cool. But getting emails, just saying hello, or, you know, sharing experiences with me, that's a big deal. It really is. And you might not think it is, but it is. Hey, the Podcast Awards are back. Podcastawards.com. It's the People's Choice Podcast Awards. We got nominated last year, and I didn't really like advertise it and try to get people to nominate me on the website. But it felt really good when I did get nominated, because some of you did nominate me, and it was nice. So, you know, I kind of want to feel that again. I don't think I'll win, but it would be nice to be nominated, because when your name appears in the nominations list, more people listen. And I wonder how many people are listening because of that. So if you get a chance, go to podcastawards.com, vote for My Life as a Foodie. In the URL box, put mylifeasafoodie.com. We're in the food and drink category. Give it a valid email address. You won't be spammed. They're not going to spam you. You can only vote once per email address, so don't bloat the box. Just vote once. Please don't stuff the ballot boxes, okay? I know people ought to try this stuff. Everyone, all these other podcasts do it. Don't do it. I appreciate any of you who'd even think of trying to do that, but I just want a handful of votes so they can listen to my show and tell me if it's worthy of a nomination. I want to be nominated because it's an affirmation that the show's decent enough to be on the list. For winning, it's not going to happen. I don't have an entire church voting for me, okay? So that's not going to happen. And that's not big a deal, but it is kind of a nice feeling to see that. And listen, before I forget, there's a recipe here for the pickled grapes at Pavolo. I promised you I was going to share this with you. Man, this show's getting late. I'm sorry. This is going to go an hour. In a saucepan, to make these grapes, okay? Saucepan, combine the following. 1.5 cups of apple cider vinegar, 1 cup of brown sugar, 8 rounds of ginger sliced 1/4 inch thick, 6 whole cloves, 2 tablespoons of coriander seeds, 2 cinnamon sticks, and 3 star anise. One of the, you know, the star anise, the stars with the anise in them, put those in there, and 1 bay leaf. Mix that really well. Bring it to a boil, and once it comes to a boil, turn off the heat, add 1 pound of seedless grapes with the stems removed. Cover the pot, allow these to sit anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes, then remove the grapes from the solution, rinse them off, and then put them in a container and into the refrigerator. They'll keep for a couple of weeks, but they won't possibly last that long. Seriously, these things are going to go really quick. They don't last. They're fantastic. Pickled grapes, like I said, little balls of Christmas that explode in your mouth. It's impressive. And I'm going to put the link to that whole Anapasti menu on our website from Dusky, Chef Dusky. She's maybe my favorite chef right now. I'm just crazy about her. She cooks Italian and cooks it very, very well. Hey, listen, next show is our annual Halloween show. And this time, this is going to be serious, all right? It's a real Halloween show. It's sponsored by After Dark Films Horror Fest. We're giving away Horror Fest t-shirts from After Dark Films. We've got DVDs from After Dark Films and Autonomous Films. We're going to have a special contest. So again, polish up on the horror movie quotes. It's going to be a little bit different, a little bit harder than last year. And as an added bonus to this year's show, we're going to be joined by Miss Horror Fest herself, Vic Tim. She's going to call in, going to haunt the hell out of you. So get ready for that, all right? You can visit horrorfestonline.com right now if you want to get a little bit, you know, in the mood, get a heads up on the show. Horrorfestonline.com, and Miss Horrorfest is Vic Tim this year. Horrorfest 4 starts in January, so we're going to be promoting that. Keep your eyes peeled also for our special post on bacon next week. I'm going to be making bacon. I've got it curing right now. It'll have be a regular blog post with pictures, not a podcast. It's curing right now, but once it's out of the cure, I'm going to rinse it, dry it. I'm going to smoke it over applewood. I started it. I got Berkshire pig. Believe it or not, I got a really good piece of a pork belly, black hog, and I'm going to give you guys a full report. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to adding salumi to the list of food passions that I have. I mean, the idea of doing this, just too cool to pass up. Seriously, DIY. And that's the show. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to check out BavoloRestaurant.com, ZazooRestaurant.com, BlackPigMeatCo.com, AdHocRestaurant.com, and Charles's blog, hundredmiles.blogspot.com. Charles is great, and thanks, Charles, again, man, for hooking us up in Sonoma. That was, it provided shows worth of material. My name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie, and I'll see you guys in time for Halloween next time. Ciao.